Hageman, 1978 at Camp Kewaunee.
Of the reminiscences that you have of your beginnings at Camp Kewaunee during the 1930s, and as I think we discussed a little bit beforehand, it'd be fun for you to tell us a little bit about how you first heard about Camp Kewaunee and some of the activities and people that you became familiar with during your early days here at camp.
Well, Camp Kewaunee has meant so much to me that it's very interesting to me to go back to how I happened to come here. I was a teacher of industrial arts in Zanesville, Ohio, and I thought better to move on to Columbus because of the educational advantages. And the first, my first year of teaching, I was hired by Mr. George Frank. He was supervisor of industrial arts for the city of Columbus, and I was hired to teach industrial arts under him. It was a great day for me because it meant so much to have an opportunity to come to Maine. I had never been into the New England states, and I thought it would be great to see Maine. So I jumped at the chance to come as a counselor. I couldn't come my first year as a teacher because I had other duties in Columbus, and I was also working on a graduate degree at Ohio State. But as soon as I could, I came, and that first year was a great one. I learned so much. I wanted to see Maine, and I jumped at the chance. I'd heard of the beautiful trees here, and I'd heard of lake trout and salmon, which we didn't have back home. So I soon learned to see and find and know people that I wanted to know. For instance, as a small boy, I often looked at telephone poles in Ohio and wondered where the trees grow that grow so tall and straight and uniform in diameter. As soon as I came to Kewaunee, I saw those trees growing here, the beautiful red pines, sometimes called Norway pines by state of Mainers. Here again, I found things in nature, flowers and animals, and birds and fishes that meant so much to me. And then the people I learned to know. Well, that very first year, Johnny Marble, who was a graduate, at that time he was just a young camper, and he was my junior counselor. Men like Hicks Lawrence, Sid Sweet, George Tittman, Bill Weld, and there was a great big fellow, Hal Wendell, who had charge of the range, and his father-in-law, H.C. Marshall. H.C. Marshall was known as the chief, the first chief of Kewaunee. He was a supervisor of education in Columbus, and he and George Frank, that very first year they opened camp, they had to solicit for boys in the city of Columbus, and they did this. They didn't have a car to drive. They drove over Columbus in by, not drove, but rode by streetcar to solicit people to send to Camp Kewaunee. And their approach was, this is a great place for people who have hay fever or asthma. The temperature, the climate, the freedom from pollen and other such undesirable plants was so good here. And so that first year they signed up, I believe it was just 16 boys to come to Camp Kewaunee. And Camp Kewaunee had been built by George and Raymond and a famous old timer in the village of Weld named Wildcat Schofield. Wildcat Schofield was the superintendent of the building. They cut the trees, peeled them, and the first year, and to cut and peel logs, trees, you have to do that a certain period of the year. The bark peels off only in the spring and the early summer, so that had to be done. And as you looked at the old dining hall and the building, the kitchen, the dining hall, you saw those beautiful trees that were so free of bark and used in the construction of the building. They looked as though they had been varnished or waxed, but it was only because they had been peeled. And then I learned to know about the great advantage of taking trips. I was asked if I would like to take charge of trips, and it was a great break for me because it meant I would get to see so much of Maine. In fact, over the period of years, I've traveled on almost every road in Maine. like the mailman, on your day off, you go places. So on my days off, in spite of the fact I had charge of trips, I went to new places, and I was able to cover a great deal of Maine and see so many things. Another thing that meant so much was to climb Mount Katahdin, the most famous mountain in the state of Maine. And up there I found to climb that great mountain and to walk over the knife edge was a thrilling thing to do. You walk over a narrow stretch that is maybe a few feet wide, 6-8 feet wide, and great drops on each side down to such places as Chimney Pond, I believe it's called. And then a few years later, we learned to climb Mount Washington over in New Hampshire. But those two mountains, the two greatest mountains in New England, and in climbing Mount Katahdin, we met so many people that were interested in the open. And to climb Mount Katahdin, the great difference between that and Mount Washington, at Mount Washington, which is higher, famous, but you can go up that mountain in a cable car, or you can drive up in a station wagon. Mount Katahdin, no one ever gets to the top of that mountain unless he is a good climber and in good physical condition. I met people up there who came from Europe and climbed mountains in Austria and Germany, and they said to me, this mountain may not be as high as some of those over there, but this is a great mountain. So as we lived on and from one year into another, I began to meet so many people that meant so much to me. I believe I know more people here in Maine through Camp Kewaunee and through people in the village here and other places. I know more fine people than, or close acquaintances that meant so much to me than the people back in Ohio. Another one of the famous trips we developed was to go out on windjammer schooners and I sailed at least 5 or 6 times, each time on a different schooner and out for 5 days in the Atlantic Ocean. And then in making that trip, we learned of Monhegan Island, that outpost island so far out that when you're out there, if you look over the rocks and across the ocean there, you're looking towards Spain. And to go out there is a very great experience. You as though you were going to another country. The people are so different and so fine, and rather quickish. In fact, they have a situation there where it's the only place on the whole coast of the Atlantic coast where they have a closed season on lobster fishing or lobster trapping. They, in order to promote better trapping, have a closed season. They fish from New Year's Day until the first day of July. Then the rest of the year it's absolutely closed, but they meet many visitors who are coming for the summer and enjoy the other things there. But the lobster are allowed to increase in size, and when they're caught during the winter months, they are worth even more money. And the people there, that we also learned to know a very famous hermit who lived on a small island near Monhegan. To get there, we had to go by rowboat or small motorboat across a small bay into an island that is absolutely free of trees, just the vegetation, the mosses and grasses and rocks. And the old hermit who lived there raised sheep, and they roamed over the island, and he lived in a little shanty made from driftwood. And when we asked him how he made a living, he said, well, when he needed a little money, he sheared the sheep. He sheared them at regular time, tossed the wool over in one corner of his room there. When he needed a bit of money, he sacked up some wool and sent it in by the mail boat and received a few dollars back. He also trapped a few lobsters, but lived a very free life. One of the boys asked him how much money he made, and we said, oh, that's not the kind of a question you ask a man. But he said, well, I'm very glad to tell you, he says, oh, $60 a year would be enough for me to live on with the things, the fish, the lobster, and the wool. So I've learned to meet so many interesting people in Maine. It's a great place to come. I've been here 46 summers. I wish I could be here another 46 summers.
Well, now you mean by 46 summers, then, that first year was what year then?
The first year was 1933.
1933.
And I've come back every summer since then. My son was entered as a camper shortly after that. He was only a little over 6 years of age, and it meant that he could have 8 or 9 years as a camper at Kewaunee and learn so many things that it'd be difficult to teach him at home and in the city. Right. The sailing and the rifle range, the swimming and the camp craft and so many, many other things that Kewaunee does for boys, it's difficult to do in the city.
Now, what lodge were you the senior counselor?
Well, I started out as counselor in the Moose Lodge. And then I made so many trips that I had to be away from camp a great deal and couldn't take care of my cabin. So they released me of that so I could give more time to the trips, which meant you'd be out of camp several days and nights at a time. But it's been such a great experience, and I love every day of it. This is certainly different from working in an industry or a business. You have so much freedom, and what you have to do, you do because you like to do it. Someone has said for every job to be done, there's an element of fun, and we certainly put that to practice here at Kewaunee. Mm-hmm. So it's a great place to be, and you can enjoy it so much, and it's a real privilege to be here.
Were there other counselors then that you would, you know, be working with as you planned during the 30s or into the 40s, the various trips that you took that worked with you or that you came to know either as campers and then later on as counselors?
So many
of them. I think some insights on your knowing someone like Carl Elmore or Wald Esterbrook or wherever, you know, some of the ones that perhaps made more than an average impact on the camp.
Oh, very much so. So many of them have become very successful in business and profession since then. Dr. Elmore was a minister of a great church in Englewood, New Jersey, and R.C. Frank was in charge of youth activities. That's how I think we brought Dr. Elmore to camp, and he was one of those outstanding ministers. But we've had other great men too. Dean Miller preached wonderful sermons and had the distinction of having a Sunday evening service, a Vesper service, out of a large rock out in the lake. And to reach there, we all had to go out by rowboat, canoe, sailboat, and other ways of getting out there. And he preached a service from a large rock out in the lake. Well, we can go on and list one person after another. Just so many of them, it'd be difficult to list all of them. I get out old directories sometime and go down through them and think of the great people I've learned to know through Kewaunee.
Now, Pop Noel, for instance, was he, did you know how he got involved in the camp?
Yes.
Was he someone that you...
Pop Noel was also a teacher in the Columbus Public School System, and George Frank came to know of him, and he was another one of those outstanding men that he was director of activities for some time. And the boys loved him, and his ideal was always to think in terms of what's good for the boy and at the same time what's interesting. A very fine, outstanding counselor, along with so many of them, it's just you can't list but a few of them.
I know, I think of Bob Noel because he was the senior counselor of the Crow's Nest in 1946 when Henry Blau and Dick Stillinger and Bill Romey and some of the others were... We were all in the Crow's Nest together, and so that's, of course, someone who I had more than just passing acquaintance with. Also, I wonder, how did you see Raymond's role in the camp? I think of many people
well,
see George and they see Raymond, and they seem to work out a very fine working arrangement.
Yes, there were two men of very different personalities, I would say. Raymond Frank, working in a church and coming from the big city. However, they were both born here in Maine and were really state of Mainers. And of course, you know that no matter how many years you have spent here in Maine, you can never be called a state of Mainer unless you were born here. So George Frank was, of course, the older of the two. And one of George's fine practices was that he had studied architecture at Columbia. Many people did not know that. When a building was planned, George planned it with precision and artistic appearance. For instance, if George Frank had you hang a sign up on the road and it was off a quarter of an inch and being plumb or level, he would see it. Likewise, if you'd set two posts up along the road there, and those posts had to be in line just perfectly with the center of the road. I helped build this newest road, and it's interesting to me the way I got across the idea of building it. We had the old road, which was narrow, built and very useful in its day when we didn't have so many automobiles and when they drove slower. But then came the modern automobile and more traffic. And so I went up the hill one day, and Dr. Elmore was coming down the main road there in his car. Dr. Defoe of Dixfield. And he must have been on an emergency call. He was driving so rapidly that the car swayed from one side of the road to another. And I knew that if someone pulled out in front of me, it would probably mean sudden death. So I came back and said to Mr. George Frank, I think we should build a new road. Someday someone may get killed up there, and it may be you. So his answer to me after several years trying to get the road was, yeah, all right, Bates, go ahead and lay it out and build it if you can. So I hired Bill Robbins, another fine fellow down the road a ways here, to help, and we went back and forth through the woods laying it out, hoping to keep below the high ground, below the hill, and above the swamp ground. And they said, I think Mr. George Frank said, make it 12 feet wide, so I made it 24. And that meant we'd let in more light and daylight and have a chance to meet other roads that came along. That was one of the things we thought was a great accomplishment. We had another one simmer. George and Raymond Frank had very little chance to discuss problems, very little privacy in the little dinky office we had. They used to sit out on the front steps. So I said, let's build an addition here where you can have some privacy. And finally we did that too. And as years went on, we saw the need for such things in development.
It's When you talk with George, and as you know, I did have an opportunity to talk with George just the April before the accident. One is really impressed with the thought and purpose, ideals that he wanted to get across to the boys, and I was wondering if there are certain campers or counselors, younger men perhaps at the time, that you recall more or less what they did with themselves as they grew older, that made themselves perhaps distinctive in their line of work.
Well, very much so. George Frank had a knack of working with boys that was outstanding. For instance, if a boy needed to be corrected for some habit he had, or maybe he left camp to see a girlfriend up the lake when he was supposed to be on duty, George's method was to help the boy and to correct him. While there's some people say, well, fire him, get rid of him, send him home, George Frank's idea was to call him in and help him and to improve the situation, try to meet his problem, not to punish him. In fact, we tried to eliminate the word punishing. Let's have camps such that there's never any need for punishment. Let's not use the word. And George was a master at that, I thought, to meet boys' problems and help them with them. And he's a great man, no question about it. He had a knack of loving children and treating them in such a way that they loved him. He had a wonderfully fine father and mother, too. His mother was known as Ma Frank. She was straight-laced and a straight, wonderful New England Yankee. She spoke with the New England accent. And one of the famous sayings that we had around here that Ma Frank expressed, I don't know how true it was, but I think it was. She said one time, you know, I think today it would be a good idea to wash down the piazza with ammonia water. that was one of the famous sayings. Then we had Whit Murphy. Whit is a brother, older brother of Reed Murphy, and Whit could imitate the state of Maynard to such a degree that he put on a great show. And then there was Hal Myers, and oh, so many of them, I'd need to spend an hour to list them. All of them.
Now, what did Whit do, for instance? Yeah. What was his kind of activity here at camp? He was working with you as a colleague here?
Which man?
Whit Murphy.
Whit. Dramatics. And He and some other counselors could put on shows so good that my wife and I, for one, when we had our day off, If it happened on the day there was a show, we would hurry back. We would cancel a lot of things to get back to Kewaunee to see the show that they put on. And then we had an orchestra, that dandy. And we had a band, and we had dramatics was important and handled well. Of course, as years go by, you change from one activity to another. One activity becomes outstanding, and one may weaken a little bit. As it happens, we make changes to try to fit them in for the good of Kewaunee and for the boys who come here. But
you mentioned Hal Myers now. That's another name that certainly, by the time I got here, you know, in the mid-40s, he was giving the service in the evening out on Bass Rock. And did he came here as a boy, or did he come as a counselor?
I think he came as a boy first. He had another one of those fine families that many of the family came. But you know something interesting about Hal that I remember so well? Hal could play the drums.
Uh-huh,
and he played them so well and put on such a good show. Every time I see him today, I think I wish Hal could put that show on again.
Right.
He did it so well. And of course, I remember him better by his talks and by his playing of drums and dramatics than I do with his other activities.
Now, he was minister of the church. Was it in Springfield, Bates?
No, that was Dean Miller. Miller was dean of religious activities at Wittenberg College in Springfield, Ohio.
I see.
Dean had also the very great distinction having been a chaplain during World War I. And since I was in World War I too, we used to like to get together and talk about World War I as being the big war.
Mm-hmm.
And how we made the world safe for the Democrats. I guess it was democracy we had reference to. But it was great to get together with Dean and talk about experiences in the World War. So I get rubbed now and then in a nice way about I was in the big war. The ones that have happened since then were the little wars.
Well, then Hal Myers was giving talks, religious kinds of talks in the 30s, was he? Or did he actually, was he just beginning that pretty much when I knew him?
I think he was pretty young then.
I know
really?
He still does it now. You know, he'll visit here
Hal
at camp.
Does a whale of a good job now. When he talks, everybody listens, and it's down to earth. He and Dr. Elmore had the knack of preaching a sermon that reached the needs of the boys. You know, so many of us, forget when we're talking that we're talking to 7, 8, 9-year-old boys, 12 and 13, counselors, and older people. And it's pretty hard to give a talk that's effective to all those different age groups, but they could do it. They had that in mind. They frequently would refer to what's good for Kiwanee. Dean Miller also had an act of having little sessions, I don't know what we call them, maybe on a Sunday night or a no scheduled time, to go out to the Campcraft Lodge and sit down, just discuss religion from a sound, practical standpoint of what your problems might be today and how you tie it up with religious beliefs. He was a master at that. He reached a lot of boys and did a lot of good. But we had so many of those men. It's not fair to single out a few. I know if I had the old directories, and I have every one from 1933 up to this year, and as I look through those, I see all those men who I knew as boys, and now they're very successful in business and professions. And it just does your heart good to go through that list and know that you knew those people. Reed Murphy and Whit, two great fellows. Reed's a very successful lawyer. And the boy, he had a knack here of playing football, or not football, baseball. Reed played center field. And that day, we had everybody in camp played on a team. George Frank played first base, and Raymond Frank pitched. And every boy from this youngest Eagle old to the older counselors was on a team. Well, my son Tommy was very much interested in baseball. But wasn't old enough to play real well. So he was on Reed Murphy's team, and Reed played center field and told the right fielder and the left fielder that if they were in trouble, he'd help them. So he played center, but he served on right and left too, and told those boys, when you get the ball, you just throw it as hard as you can to me, and I'll do the rest. And that's just one of the individuals I learned to know, that as I say, there's so many of them, they meant so much, and taken hours to list all of them.
Now, Reed, did he have a lodge then, part of the time when
well,
he was
that,
up here?
Yes. I think at that time he was just a camper. And then
I see.
A junior counselor, then a very good senior counselor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's the case with so many boys. They're young and active, and they stay on, they become junior counselors, and they turn out to be very fine senior counselors. That's one of the great things about Kiwanee, I think. So many former campers are now successful counselors, and that speaks well for the camp.
Mm-hmm. Just even today, the plaque that was discovered out at the Woodcraft Cabin,
yes, sir,
and seeing people like Bittenbender, for instance, and the name, some of these names I was well aware of as a camper in the 40s because I made up the wigwam envelopes, and I'd see Reverend Sweet. And I would see a number of other names of people that I had never met, but knew had an important role to play in the camp during the 30s. What is your first recollection of Walt Estabrook? I mean, Walt has taken over a terrific burden, in a sense. It's a challenge, and it's always fun to hear.
Well, Walter and his brother were both campers first, and then I remember Walter as being a counselor in charge of archery and doing it so well, and teaching boys to love the practice of good archery. And also that I think his first year he worked as a kitchen helper, mm-hmm, much as you do when you go to college. And one of the things you learn in college is how to be a good table waiter.
Right.
And I think those kind of people put a lot of emphasis on. I remember back how good manners were taught in the kitchen. Oh, yes, and in a way, too, in the dining room. I mean, another thing that they learned so well is how to live together in a cabin, how to make your bed. We've heard parents say their boy came home and never before had he cared about making his bed. Now it had to be made just a certain way. Also, Maybe the parents were a little forgetful at mealtime, and the boy would say, well, you must ask a blessing first. So such things as that they've learned at camp, and learned it so well and so effectively. When a boy can come home and his mother says he learned a lot of good things at camp, we think we've done a good job and put it into practice at home. Again, I say, I think that one of the greatest values in camp is just learning to live together. And then also the one of the great values is recognition for accomplishment. I think that everybody, young and old, or regardless of your background, you kind of appreciate or crave a little recognition for what you do. So we've emphasized that, and I think it's worked to very good advantage. The recognition for achievement and accomplishment is something that's put across at the Saturday night campfire, and I think it has great value. Just another one of those values that you don't realize at the time how important they are.
One thing that I'm wondering, and we're getting a little bit on first eye of the tape, Nate. One thing that you did touch on was, of course, your terrific role in the area of trips. And I can't help from thinking of the trips that I went on to Coos Canyon, Sunday afternoon swim there at the canyon, and then your outpost camp that came up later. Do you want to discuss a little bit of
your
tripping schedule and going to the lakes?
Yes, quite a bit, Ed. Trips meant so much to me. I love trips and enjoy going. Something like the mailman's holiday, you know, when he's off duty, he wants to go out and hike around. But, great places to go to. One of them that stands out from the very early years was Tim Pond. Tim Pond's way up near the Canadian border. And you had to hike 6 miles after you parked your car to get in there. They had an old buckboard that they drove. You couldn't hike it. You could ride on a buckboard pulled by a team of horses. And one of those horses was blind. It was so interesting to watch how when they'd come to a bad place in the road and stop, or a boulder to go over, they would stop, and that horse would seem to feel its way over there. Tim Pond, where we caught beautiful trout by the hundreds. It was a great place to go. And then George Frank took me on a fishing trip. And the first time I ever caught trout, I think. We went up to a stream up north of Nash Stream, up north of Stratton. And we took along a pack and a fry pan and some coffee and a few other things. As we caught the trout, we dressed them and ate them along the stream. It was great. Coos Canyon is a famous place to swim over on Swift River, just 13, 14 miles from here. And we'd frequently go there on Sunday afternoon. It's a deep canyon between sharp rocks and deep water, and a good place to dive. And a beautiful thing, too, about those streams. The water's so pure. It comes right down out of the mountains. No pollution, no habitation upstream, no camps, no farms. You can drink the water. For instance, the fishing for trout. The first year, it was very difficult for me to believe that you could drink the water you were fishing in. But when I saw so many people do it, and that is state of Mainers, I soon learned that you could. The water is quite pure. So other trips, the characters that you met, we had a very famous guide. In fact, I helped to hire him. And we had a canoe counselor named Fran Luoma. Fran Luoma was Finnish. He came from Springfield, Mass, where he was in the Springfield College of Physical Education, is it? They trained to be coaches and so on. Fran Luoma was a great guy, a great athlete, and put on shows out on the beach, and was very likable. We had another man came from New Zealand, and first, I want to tell you about the guide, this Pearly Durgan.
Yeah.
Hurley Durgan was a man who had been a border patrolman. He had been a game warden. He had been a log driver. And he knew the rivers. He knew them well. He knew where the bad rapids were. He knew what to avoid. He took us on the Kennebec River, and it was the most wonderful trip you could think of. One thing I remember about Pearly that stuck out in my mind. One time we were on the Chain of Ponds trip. It was a series of nice lakes clear up on the Canadian border above Eustis. And we camped for the night, and Pearly would pull up to the shore. And first thing he would do was to get out and start to prepare the meal. He prepared where he was to stay last, but he's interested in the meal. So we were cooking and preparing a meal, and had some fry pans and other utensils over the fire. And one of the boys were crowding around, frequently a little bit chilly. He liked the fire, the cook fire. One boy stepped over a pan, dropped a little sand in the fry pan. So Pearly didn't say a word. He was never profane. He was so wonderful with the boys that he just walked away about 25 feet and started another fire. And his answer to the boys was, "Say, look, boys," he says, "now this fire is where I'm going to cook. That one over there is for you. But this is where I'm cooking. Now you stay out of the kitchen." And that went across so well.
Mm-hmm.
And just one experience after another that we had on those trips. It meant so much, the way to get along with people and how to follow a good leader.
We were just looking at some of the old films last night, you know.
Yeah.
And Pearly Durgan was there standing up in his canoe.
Yes.
Was we're shooting the rapids on, yeah, the Kennebec. And one other scene that was tied into there was showing you and your gold panning.
Oh, yeah.
And how did you ever think about getting that activity
well,
started?
Well, sir, way back when I first came here, we'd heard, I don't know through what sources, but it is authentic, that the first gold found in the United States was found in Swift River at Byron. Now, I think that's authentic. I've seen it on maps, and I've seen it in other places. It's a little hard to get complete information on it. But Swift River, 15 miles from here, over, or a little less than that, is where that gold is found. So George Frank and I found a man who could show us how. He was from over at Phillips. And he came over and took us over to Swift River with a gold miner's pan. And he dug up some grass, this very heavy, wiry grass that grows on rocks and sometimes right out in the middle of the stream. He dug that up carefully and tore it apart, shaped out the sand, the fine sand known as magnetite and garnet sand, and emptied it. Put it in a coal miner's pan and worked it out. We had a few little flakes of gold, which was really quite interesting to see for the first time. Then we developed sluice boxes, and we began to learn better how to pan gold. Now, there are all sorts of theories, where it comes from, how it got there, and where to find it, and how much is it worth, and so on. Now, the nearest theory we have, and we find from geologists so on, that gold is deposited in many places, probably brought down by the glacier thousands of years ago and deposited in the sands and the gravel. And if you work hard, you'll find it. Now, it's not easy to find. If it was easy, it wouldn't be worth so much. Back when we first started to pan gold, it was worth $35 an ounce. Today, it's $180 an ounce,
mm-hmm,
and it keeps going up. Some people believe that it may reach $500 an ounce. Now, an ounce seems like a very small amount, but when you try to get it out of the river in the form of gold, it seems like an enormous amount of weight. So it's a thrilling experience, but like fishing, sometimes you don't get any. And you have to learn to have a lot of patience and hard work, and sore back and dirty, in order to find gold. You find very small flakes and occasionally a large one, but it's a thrill. I have panned gold with a great many different kinds of people, some ordinary people, some lumberjacks, some geologists, some half-breed Indians, and some people who were very, very wealthy. In fact, there was one man, I won't name him, you probably wouldn't know him, but he was very wealthy. I'd say he was a millionaire. And I was showing him how to pan gold, and we found a few little flakes about the size of a pinhead. It was very interesting, but he just about went crazy when he found those pieces of gold. In fact, I believe I know now why prospectors murdered each other for each other's gold, because there's so much excitement to finding it. And this man said, let's find the mother lode. Let's go up the tumble down. Let's buy the mountain. Let's get more gold. So there are a lot of interesting experiences come from it. Many people are over there today, every day of the week, I mean, looking for gold. And it takes patience and time and hard work. You don't get it easily. If you could get it easily, it wouldn't be worth so much. So gold panning is an interesting experience, but one that takes a lot of patience and perseverance.
Any other trips that you've talked about the Windjammer, would you want to talk about any other lakes, like the Rangeley Lake? When did this get started?
Every trip we take has some pleasure to it, some significance. And Rangeley Lakes were famous. Several years ago, it was a very, very popular summer resort, and people came by train to Phillips and Farmington, and then by stagecoach over to Rangeley, where they came and stayed for maybe a week or a month or a whole summer. It was difficult to get there, and we didn't have the use of rapid transportation like automobiles, so when they came, they stayed a long period of time. Johnny Marble's grandfather had one of the famous hotels on Rangeley. And Rangeley's a famous place for fishing, for salmon and trout. So it has changed tremendously since those days. But then another place today that is so famous, you go north of Rangeley to Stratton and back towards Kingfield, and you come to Sugarloaf Ski Area. Sugarloaf Ski Area has all been developed since I've been coming to camp, and I've been here these 46 summers, but Sugarloaf was not considered in those early days. But then some businessmen got together and raised quite a bit of money, and Sugarloaf today is one of the most famous ski areas in the mm-hmm, East, mm-hmm. Believe it or not. But they have gondola, towers and means of getting to the top of the mountain. The gondolas were made in, in Switzerland. Towers were manufactured in Germany. So you see they have some very fine, expensive equipment there. And they have many tournaments and contests, and it's developed into one of the very finest ski areas in the East. And another thing about the place, as you drive up there along the road, you see all of these places where people have shelters and camps and cabins that are built on the design of the Swiss chalets. A-frame types of building. The purpose of having an A-frame is a very steep roof in order that the sole slide off instead of building up and building up great weight. And as you drive through the country here, you see some old farm buildings that have flat roofs and heavy snow, and they're caved in. And here at camp, one of the important things in the winter is to have a caretaker who watch the camps and learn when to shovel the snow off. It's nothing unusual to have 30-inch snow and build it up to, for a whole season in the winter. I understand they have about 100 inches. And if you let that accumulate on a roof, you're pretty sure of some damage. So that's an important part. But every trip's been interesting to me. I am kind of proud of the fact that I look at the map and can say there's only two or three, four main roads that I haven't been on. And a lot of roads I've been on, they're not on the map. They're back roads.
You worked with Art Kiefer, too, and, you know, that's one person we haven't really brought into the conversation yet. And I don't know, how did you, when did you first get to know Art, and then if you wanted to elaborate a little bit on his mineral trips? Those were always a famous part.
Well, Art Kiefer was one of those, another one of those great men. He was, I would say, about 6'6" and 215 or 20 pounds. He played football at Ohio State in the championship years way back when Chick Harley was a famous player, and Art Kiefer was on the line, tackler, guard, and he played every game, 60 minutes in every game. They didn't have the platoon system then. And being a good, big, husky football player, you had a lot of respect for him when he came up here and taught nature. But he was outstanding in his knowledge of plants and flowers and animals. I can tell you many things that he did. Some of them we don't put on the tape and the stories he told about animals. But he was one of those great men that you learn to know so well. And I'm glad you mentioned his name because, as I say, there's so many of them, so many great men that you live to remember and influenced your life. And he's just one of the greats.
Mineral trips, then. I know that you went to Parham's. That was always kind of part of it, but you actually got in and they dug around a little bit, too, didn't they?
Parham was another one of those great men. He operated a little one-man mineral shop for several years, and then he developed open mines and understanding of the great wealth, the mineral wealth that is found in Maine. I understand there's many 40 different kinds of interesting minerals, the main ones being the tourmalines. Tourmaline's a semi-precious stone that can be cut. And he found them. He later became the state geologist, and then he did so well with his small shop that he got quite a write-up in the Reader's Digest. And after that write-up in Reader's Digest, he had to enlarge his store so much that he called for 17 clerks. And from that time on, he was made. But he had a great knowledge of minerals and always willing to help boys to identify what they find. We used to always visit his small shop after we visited some of the mines that were open in the way of what had been brought out and dumped out with the material. We would always sort through and find little particles of quartz and mica and tourmalines, the white ones, the red ones, and so on. And if we found a good piece now and then, he would offer to buy it. But he was always willing to identify what the boys would find. A fine man, great man in his field. And now, since he is not living, his wife and his daughter continue on with the shop, and I think it's famous. Parham's Mineral Shop is known, I should say, throughout the United States as an outstanding place. So just one activity after another that we learned to develop here. Many, many boys have gone on to college and taken geology as a major because of the interest that was developed here at Kewaunee. So it's played an important part in the lives of many boys in selecting their college major.
Mm-hmm. You know, one other name that comes to my mind, I'm thinking more now of your you and your wife up at the Maine Lodge, and some of the people that were kind of the support staff, and one couple that really made a tremendous impression on me, I guess, because I guess one way to every boy's heart is through his stomach. It was Emma and Lawrence Briggs.
Right. Lawrence and Emma Briggs. They're great.
And do you remember when they first started coming?
Well,
could you give us some insight on to Lawrence and Emma
first,
as individuals?
First cook I remember was named, can't say it, but he'd been a cook at the headmaster of the Englewood School for Boys. Burke Carlton was his name. He lived here in Maine, but he had cooked down there, and he was hired. Then shortly after that, when he couldn't come, he and his wife, somehow or another, we got Emma and Lawrence Briggs from over at Madison. And boy, what good cooks they were. Lawrence Briggs could cook a ham like no one else ever cooked it. He would use brown sugar and pineapple juice, and I don't know what all, but that ham tasted better than anything you could ever buy at a restaurant. And his wife was a great cook for apple pies and other things. And another interesting thing about his wife, we later, when Lawrence passed away, they had other cooks come. And we had a man here who was a transient cook and answered an advertisement when we needed a cook. He had cooked in some rough and tumble places and lumber camps and others. And I heard him say one time something that might be misinterpreted. He says, that woman, Emma Briggs, acts as though she owned the place. And this is what he meant. He said, she works as though she owned the place. He says, if in the middle of the night a little storm came up, that woman would get up and come down to the kitchen to make sure that every window was closed. Her heart and soul was in taking good care of the Kewanee cooking. And another couple that you make an indelible impression on your life, you remember them as being so outstanding.
Now, where were they in Maine? They were Maynards, too, weren't they?
They were state of Maynards, came from over at Madison, which is about 40, 50 miles from here. And I don't know just what their backgrounds was. Lawrence Briggs was very active in other things. He'd get out, pick and shovel, and help to smooth up things around the kitchen and do a lot of work. And they were just outstanding people. Academically educated to a very great degree, but people of great intelligence and integrity, and people you learn to love and have a lot of respect for. Oh, we could go on and name them over and over and over, the people down to the ones we have right now, such as Ruth Boardman, who just does a remarkable job of cooking. And here we are serving 150 people are off to a great many more than that and doing a beautiful job of it. You wonder how they do it. But they learn how to know what boys like and how to serve them, how to give them, and how they do eat. I wish counselors and boys could understand how much it costs. Because here, where else? If you ever go to a restaurant to buy a meal, you get what's served to you. Here, you get that, and then you have seconds and thirds.
I know.
If you paid for a meal that you got here at Kewanee, the way you do it in a restaurant, it would be prohibitive. But the food is great, and we get so much of it, so good and so much, that I think we overlook how great it is. I think there's so many great things about Kewanee that we just take for granted, that if we didn't have them, then we'd realize how important they are. I have had an experience on these trips of going into a lumber camp to eat. One thing about eating in a lumber camp is so different from what it is here. When you eat in a lumber camp, the men sit at a long table and they don't talk. Mm-hmm. They just eat and they keep quiet. Or they may say, pass the butter, pass the bread, and that's it. If you do talk too much, you're thought of as not being so desirable. One time, I on a canoe trip way up the Canadian border, I had a nice experience. The boys were in the canoes, and I had some idle time, so I went up to the border and asked the customs office man if I could cross over into Canada to buy a meal. To a little town of St. Augustine de Woburn, and we were at Coburn Gore, and he says, yes, you could, but you don't need to. You just go down the street here to that sawmill and find the owner, and you can get a meal there. I said, could I buy it? He says, you won't need to buy it. You go down the street here to the one building that has paint on it, and that'll be his office. That's the only building that has paint. And so I went in with him, and the men working in the mill had had their meal, and the owner, I forgot his name, he's a Frenchman from up in Quebec, and the French call that Quebec, not Quebec, Quebec. And he said, oh, sure, you can get a meal here, and it won't cost you anything. And he says, come on in and sit down with me, and as soon as that cook's through eating, well, we can eat. And we sat down at the table, and a great massive, two of us, great massive platters of fish and potatoes and vegetables. But the thing that I remember so well, towards the end for dessert, there were two mammoth pies, not the ordinary pie, maybe 12 or 14 inches in diameter. One was blueberry and one was red raspberry. And he just pushed the two pies across the table to me and says, "Here, we cut our own up here." Meaning you could have as large a piece as you wanted. Mm-hmm. That was something I remember so well.
One other person that certainly made their mark on camp that lived in the main lodge was Cam Scarlett. I would wonder your impressions of him as a camper and then later as a counselor and the writer of the
Cam
famous log.
Was another one of those great men, as I say, so many, you just can't miss all of them. You'd have to have a list of several pages to list the numbers. Cam was in charge of the Eagle Lodge for years. My son Tom, who's now nearly 50, was a six-year-old camper, maybe seven, and in Cam Scarlett's lodge. And how many good things he learned to come home by, and how much more courteous he was, and how careful in his food habits, and how well he made his bed. And then Cam Scarlett handled those little eagles, and believe me, they were expressing good manners at the table. If they didn't, they were sent back to their lodge. But Cam, along with that, wrote the famous camp log. And he walked around camp with the clipboard taking down notes as he saw them on anything that would be interesting to the whole camp to hear on Saturday Night Log. And Cam became famous for the camp log and did such a remarkable job of it. He was just, I say, another one of the greats. You could go on ahead and name so many of them.
What was that famous nurse that they thought maybe there might even be some romantic implications
sure.
at one point with Cam?
Her name was Marie McElwee.
Oh, yes.
She came from Columbus. And another one of those great people who did a good job and a good nurse. But I don't know about their personal affairs.
Well, what about, there was a lot of stories, you know, the counselors would liven up the place and have fun, and they would tell maybe the younger kids that they have a case of earlobes, and they better go up to see the nurse, and the nurse would cooperate, and she'd put a little bit of Mercurochrome on each of their earlobes, and then other people around would know that they had been taken.
Well, they had a lot of great sense like that. Sending a boy up the shop to get a left-handed monkey wrench or some such thing. Always harmless and interesting and add to the fun of the place.
Were you ever active in the plans for the Duke, for instance?
Oh, boy.
Were you ever part of that group?
The Duke of Zanzibar was one of those people that showed up after everyone else was asleep and stirred up some mysterious things that happened. And the next morning you might find a part of your toilet set on the top of the flagpole, or you might find the old bouncing buggy wrapped in toilet paper, or one thing after another, but all of them harmless. One thing we did learn to do, though, was to be very careful in your selection of stories. And we discouraged those stories that would affect the boy's sleep. For instance, just said that too many ghost stories cause a boy wetting the bed. And if that's what a ghost story does, you better not have it. But we learned to be a little more selective. Another thing, back to Dean Miller. What a storyteller he was at the lodge. And other men who could tell beautiful stories. George Tipman. I remember one time I was on night duty, and after taps, frequently a little discussion of bedtime story, reading the Bible or some such thing in order just before time to go to sleep, and something was soothing and would be conducive to sleep. And I remember going to George Stickman's lodge to see if all the boys were accounted for, and he motioned me away. It was just an important part in his story, and didn't want me to step in, and he was right in doing that.
Thank you, Bates. This is Ed Hamblin signing off for now.
Was he from the east or the west? The name just came up more than once.
George and Raymond were both born in Maine, born down near Portland. Their mother was born over here near Farmington at a little town of Temple. It's just the other side of Mount Blue. And the father, too. They were all state of Mainers and good ones. But
The Tittman, the fellow you were mentioning that you had gone by the lodge to,
yeah.
Where was he born? Where did he come from?
He came from the east. Raymond Frank would have hired him.
I see.
And had an equal number of greats from the east and from the west. Uh-huh. And you frequently refer to the eastern boys and the western boys.
Yeah.
But today, we're almost worldwide, 6, 7, or 8 foreign countries. I like to tell people that we have boys from so many states. Even had a boy from Alaska.
Uh-huh.
It was a case of a relative living there, two boys coming from Los Angeles, whose father was a former camper here, now a physician out there. And this homecoming we're having right now, it's unbelievable the professions that these men are in.
Uh-huh.
When you knew them as very ordinary little campers, but we've had boys from 17, 18 states, 6, 7, or 8 foreign countries. Like right now, it's quite interesting to say we have 12 or 13 from Madrid, Spain, or other parts of Spain. Spain and Venezuela and London and several other countries. I can't think of them right now, but that speaks well for Kewanee. We take campers from all over the world, so to speak, in a way.
One thing that probably this